From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Today is all about how we talk. What does a native Georgian sound like? What words do they use? How do they pronounce them? We all know the movies aren't great at sounding authentically Southern.
As a bushwhacking guerrilla army, we're going to be doing one thing and one thing only. Killing Nazis.
We would love to hear your accent. I would love to hear it, Southern or not. Do people ever comment on your accent? Do you say soda instead of pop? Call 404-500-9457. You can also tweet us at OSD Talk or post on Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. We are talking today about talking, specifically how I sound different from people who were born and raised in the South. There's one word I don't use, y'all. It's as Southern as, well, as one of our listeners put it, God and football. But do we know where that signature Southern abbreviation came from? We asked a few folks at a high school football game in Woodstock.
The word y'all, a conjunction of you all, predominantly used in the South.
Definition is plural you, you people, you guys, if you were from the Northeast.
It's y'all. It's just a Southern thing, I guess.
Oh, I text y'all. And then if it's like y'all's place, it's like Y apostrophe A-L-L apostrophe S.
I'm from New York, and I pretty much adapted that about a couple years ago since my fiancé says it and everybody in the world says it.
I lived in New York for a while, and I said it there, too, so I'm good with it. I'm proud.
That was Jonathan, Andrew Levinsky, Amanda, Josh, and CD there. The word y'all actually has some pretty surprising origins, and my guest today can explain. Cameron Hunt McNabb is an assistant professor of English for Southeastern University, and she joins us now. Hi, Cameron.
Hi.
Let's dig a little deeper into the origins of y'all. Is y'all considered a credible word?
Yes. So the Oxford English Dictionary is kind of the academic standard dictionary that scholars would go to, and y'all is included in there as a contraction of you all. And I think more recently, too, a linguistic study has appreciated or gained an appreciation for regional dialects, and so has given more credence to a word like y'all.
So you began to look into the origins of y'all. Why? What caught your interest there?
Well, as I shared in the an article that I recently wrote, I say it, obviously, and I went to college in the North, and so I was kind of teased about it, and it became an identity marker for me as being a Southerner. And so more recently, though, I teach a History of the English Language class, and I was assigning some readings to my students on different dialects. And one of those dialects was obviously the Southern dialect. And so as my students were reading about different markers of the Southern dialect, I got more curious about what were the origins and the history of y'all, because I think, like many people, I assumed people just started to contract you all, you know, together. And the deeper that I dug into the issue, the more I found that that is actually not what scholars think.
So it is not a contraction of you all.
Well, there's two camps of scholars that argue about this. And of course, modern users are using it as a contraction of you all. So when they say y'all, if you ask them what they meant, they mean you all, you know, y'all.
Right.
Total.
All y'all.
All y'all, right. But the origins, I think, about where that word became popular are not just Southerners kind of woke up one day and decided to blend these two words together. So there's kind of two camps, and one camp kind of traces it back to a Scots-Irish pronoun, ye aw, that would have come over with Irish immigrants in
Which
the
means,
1800s.
What does it mean? Ye
aw? It's the second, ye aw, and it's just the second person plural, exactly like y'all.
Like, It's you, plural.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And then the other camp has looked at its long history in African-American dialects.
Uh-huh.
And some of our early records trace it into early African-American populations. And so that camp focuses on those early dialects, which had that sort of you, plural. similar to Gullah would be a kind of modern example of that, and how it would have become prevalent first in the African-American population and then spread more largely.
I wonder, there's also a connection between the use of a word like y'all and being uneducated. I want to play you this comment from Stephen Colbert. He's from South Carolina, so he's authentically Southern. Does not have a Southern accent, and he was on 60 Minutes back in 2006 explaining why he consciously got rid of his Southern accent.
At a very young age, I decided I was not going to have a Southern accent. When I was a kid watching TV, if you wanted to use a shorthand that someone was stupid, you gave the character a Southern accent. Now, that's not true. Southern people are not stupid. But I didn't want to seem stupid. I wanted to seem smart.
So is there a connection historically between somebody who's maybe rural or unlettered or lesser educated and the use of that word y'all?
Yes, I mean, absolutely. The origins trace back to Appalachia in particular, which is a very rural and historically working class and kind of marginalized area. And so as I was even going through a lot of the records, that was what was coming up, is that people who were recording the phrase were correcting it, you know, were turning it into you all instead of y'all.
Oh, when they took quotes from people, they would actually rewrite y'all to you all.
Yeah, because they were so used to writing in what they thought was standard proper English. That they were correcting it. So there is a long history of viewing it as not just a dialect, but as a marker of a certain socioeconomic class.
I wanted to play you one more clip, and you mentioned that the study of regional dialects has kind of risen in the past decade or so, and it's actually started to appear in popular culture more, even so. What comes to mind for us is Friday Night Lights in Nashville, and they use y'all all the time, and they don't use it, as Stephen Colbert described, to show that someone is stupid. Someone actually compiled on YouTube all of the times that Connie Britton's character on Friday Nights said y'all.
Listen to this, y'all.
Listen, y'all.
Listen, y'all.
Y'all, listen to this.
I want to tell y'all.
I want y'all to speak up.
Quiet down, y'all.
What are y'all doing?
You know what, y'all? Get out. Right now, y'all.
What is behind this sort of renaissance in the appreciation of regional dialects, do you think?
Well, I think that scholars have kind of focused on this for a while, but I think more recently the general population is starting to gain an understanding and an appreciation of how language shapes identity and how language shapes culture and even how language can be powerful. And so out of that, I think, has come a number of television shows, as you mentioned. I really like Friday Night Lights, that have embraced regional identity instead of trying to be more kind of mainstream and kind of try to give no hint of a dialect. I used to joke about shows like Friends and Seinfeld that these New Yorkers have no New York accent, right? They have a very flat accent. But more recently, we have shows like, you know, even Duck Dynasty or the different reality TV shows like The Real Housewives of, you know, wherever that embrace characters who are using their native dialects.
That's Cameron Hunt McNabb. She teaches a class on the history of English language at Southeastern University. Cameron, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Whether you use the word or not, at least one writer argues that y'all is an important and useful word. Van Newkirk is a writer for The Atlantic, and he makes the case that America needs y'all.
How y'all doing? A greeting as Southern as a bowl of grits. It rolls off the tongue in a single open mouth utterance. It's sweeter than honey and often saturated with hidden meaning. Y'all can open up a dialogue with a room full of strangers with ease. Part of that ease hinges on the incredible versatility of the phrase's most important word, y'all. That strange regional and ethnic conjunction offers a simplicity to speech that can't be found elsewhere. It is a magnificently elegant linguistic creation. There are no distinct second-person plural pronouns in modern standard English. Ye once served that purpose. A good look at the King James Version of the Bible can give a good sense of the usage. Ye are the light of the world, Jesus told a crowd in Galilee. But nowadays, ye and some other fun Middle English pronouns have fallen by the wayside, except at medieval times and in fantasy novels. Even thou, the etymologically informal brother of you, fell off the linguistic map around the 17th century, which, thanks to the abandonment of the formal-informal system of pronouns influenced by French, leaves us with one word, you, that pronoun of all trades. You is all we English speakers have to refer to any person or group or large crowd, regardless of status or size. How did this happen? Anyone who's used English in any capacity knows that you is a sorry excuse for a plural pronoun. Imagine the confusion of walking into a crowded room and yelling, you need to listen up. Who would everyone assume you were referring to? How could they tell? This is some terribly inefficient language, and it's high time for a fix. You guys isn't sufficient as a national solution. Firstly, we live in an era of increased scrutiny and consideration over the gender of pronouns that we use, especially as feminism and trans activism expand and shape languages. They is entering the picture as a formal gender-neutral singular and plural pronoun. And although guys has lost some of its masculine connotation in the English language by proximity to you, it's still a word that immediately connotes a group of men. Plus, it's just a damn clunky way to speak. There's no flow to it, and the slang nature of guys makes it ill-suited for formal speeches or addresses. I say to you guys today, my friends, though, even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. Take some gravitas away from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., no? Even in the realm of slang, you guys isn't really all that cool, conjuring visions of the Fonz and his leather jacket, hey, or Eric Cartman. The only person to successfully get away with you guys and sound cool was Sloth, and very few people will ever be as awesome as Sloth. Which is why we need y'all. It doesn't suffer from having the gender implications or general lameness of you guys. It sounds elegant, warm, and inviting. It offers both economy and an end to second-person ambiguity. Teach it in schools across the country. Mouth it to babies. Put it on end-of-grade test. Let's give y'all its rightful place in language proper. Y'all hiring? Y'all okay? The possibilities are endless, and a simple substitution could actually solve a real problem in modern English that will only grow as we continue to examine how gender works in language. It could provide a better and gender-neutral word. It could relieve you of the impossible task of ostensibly functioning in so many roles, and maybe even along the way, ease some of the regional and racial stigmatization of language and slang. It's worth a shot, y'all.
That's Van Newkirk, a writer for The Atlantic. Coming up, what does the Georgia accent really sound like? But first, how the sound of the South gets stereotyped in movies. This is On Second Thought.
Born on a mountaintop in Tennessee, green estate in the land of the free, raised in the woods so's he knew every tree, killed him a bar when he was only three. Davy, Davy Crockett, king of the wild frontier.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Before the break, we talked about the origins of that most Southern word, y'all. You hear it a lot when Hollywood scriptwriters are portraying Southerners. Southern speech and culture don't get a lot of respect in the movies.
You crying, boy? You crying, boy? Maybe we'll go back down to McDonald's and get you a Whamburger, some French fries. How about a Wineken? You little sissy boy! Def Leppard sucks!
You can thank Joe Dirt for that portrayal of the South. More and more films are being made right here in Georgia, and we wanted to know if Hollywood has actually learned a thing or two about how to portray the South, like the fact that not everyone has a really fake Southern accent. We invited a panel here to talk about that. Stratton Leopold is a film producer based in Savannah with credits like Mission Impossible 3. He also did casting work back in the day for the Dukes of Hazzard. Hi, Stratton.
Hi, good morning.
Over here on my right is Eddie Van Mueller. He's a film and media studies lecturer at Emory University. Hi, Eddie.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Good to have you. And we welcome back our own Kalina Bowler. She's a regular guest in the break room and a film scout. Hi, Kalina.
Hey.
Let's start, Eddie, with Burt Reynolds, because to a certain extent he represents a kind of a change, I would think, in the portrayal of Southerners. I wonder if you agree with that Burt Reynolds was kind of a miles marker.
Yeah, I think you can't actually overstate Burt Reynolds' importance to the South on screen and the making of films in the South. Smokey and the Bandit was a huge film. The only film that made more money than Smokey and the Bandit that year was Star Wars. I mean, this was a colossal, colossal film. And in a way, he kind of took that Rhett Butler stereotype from back in the Gone with the Wind era, and he updated it and threw it into a Trans Am and made it sexy. And the idea of sort of a sexy redneck was very novel, or at least hadn't been around since Gone with the Wind.
Well, since you mentioned Gone with the Wind, let's start there. Of course, made in 1939.
Red, you go. Where shall I go? What shall I do?
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
Stratton, it's been a long time since Gone with the Wind was made. I wonder if we still are sort of making films about the South that are in that film's shadow.
I don't think we are. I think the stories are manifold here. The South has been described by others as the Ireland of the U.S. because the stories are so wonderful. They abound. There's a story that I'm getting a script on that's set in Mississippi, true story, which is the only reason it's set in Mississippi, it happened there, is a story with the mantle, with the framework of being in the South. But it's a great story. So I don't think so, because the stories are wonderful.
Okay, so Kalina, let's bring you into this. And I wanted to talk about a film that you think got it right. And that's Eve's Bayou. It was made in 1997. But the family is a family from Louisiana, and it was back set in the 1960s at least. Let's take a listen to Eve's Bayou here.
Mommy keeps stabbing herself in the kitchen. Show her your hands, Mama.
I think you better hush.
And where's Daddy? He's never home. He's supposed to be home sometimes.
Listen, you little ingrate. Your father works hard so we can have a house with four bathrooms.
Not every night he's not working. I know he's not.
Why do you say this one gets it right?
Because for me, it was the first time I was able to look at a film that spoke to a Southern culture that I immediately recognized. This was a Black middle-class family that had a very universal, dramatic story going on. And I hadn't seen that before, and I want to actually see more of that. And the South is not a monolith. We have so many different stories to tell. And this, like I said earlier, this is a story that I absolutely immediately was drawn to, but anybody of any race, creed, whatever could understand the story. It just happened to show Black people in a Black culture of the South.
So, okay, so Eddie, let's talk about the things that Hollywood still gets wrong. And I want you to take a listen here to a comment from William Mark McCullough. He's a Savannah-based actor and filmmaker. He just wrapped up filming on the Tom Cruise movie that was here called Mina. And we spoke with him earlier. Here's his comment.
So many times I'll go in for auditions for something modern and they ask for a Southern accent and I give it to them. They're like, no, we want a real Southern accent, like Gone with the Wind. And I laugh, and like, no one talks like that anymore. But generally, people who are familiar with the South and have been here, they understand the nuances and the variations in Southern accents.
But, you know, Eddie, that's funny, but it also represents a real problem if people are making movies about the South and just inherently do not understand it.
I agree the South is by no means monolithic. But I also think one of the issues is an issue that has to do with just the nature of cinema and film. This is a medium that often relies on stereotype. And what makes it kind of problematic is the idea of what the South is that many people have, they get from television and film. So when we see the repetition of certain kinds of stereotypes or certain kinds of accents or certain kinds of cultures on screens, that makes that that image seem more permanent to us. And as anyone who's a resident here knows, there isn't one Southern accent.
Yeah, that's very true.
there are 500 Southern accents, and there isn't one South or even one Atlanta. And that complexity, while we love to see that in films, and we do see it in some movies, complexity is really not what entertainment trades in.
That's true. Let me then play for you a clip from the movie that almost everyone mentions when we talk about the stereotypical South. This is a scene from 1989's Driving Miss Daisy, filmed right here in Georgia, Jessica Tandy and Morgan Freeman starring.
Didn't I tell you to wait for me in the back?
Well, yes, but I just trying to... Well, there's two other chauffeurs right behind me there.
You made me look like a fool. A G.D. fool.
Oh, Miss Daisy. Lord knows you ain't no fool.
Slow down.
Kalina, a colossal hit still playing in theaters. I mean, the play itself is still playing in theaters. What makes this one a stereotype?
I don't know any black guy who talks like that. I mean, maybe they did. I can only go off a reference of what I know. And nobody in my family, none of my friends, none of their fathers, none of their grandfathers, none of them talked like that. And I think, just like you said, it's an exaggeration that sells tickets. And if Hollywood filmmakers are having that flyover mentality and they say, oh, you know, they sound like that, and, you know, this is what... you know, docile black drivers sound like, then that's what they're going to try to cast and try to...
Docile, what an awful word.
but I think it's the right word. And here's the thing. It's a great performance.
Yeah, absolutely. It's 100%.
It's a wonderful film, but we have to be able to look past that and be open to problematizing what the representation of race in the South, of class
yes.
in the South. The assumption that the sort of Joe Dirt stereotype, the idea of the South as providing a kind of underclass,
yeah,
right. That this is really pervasive, and when we see people of upper classes in films about the South, they are Miss Daisy. They're these sort of patrician post-plantation figures.
Drinking mint juleps. Well, Stratton, I wanted to play for you a clip go ahead.
Just a sec. No, I've actually worked with Morgan. And, of course, he lives in Mississippi. He's from there. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't around during that period. But I don't know how much of the accent was over the top and how much was actually. I have no idea. I know the picture did very, very well. And as far as the white Southerners, there's a fella in Jackson, Mississippi that calls me all the time, and I can see him on the damn veranda. I mean, the accent is still there. It's right there. Well, okay, you started. I cut you off. I'm sorry.
It's okay. I just wanted to play for you a clip from a movie that you mentioned when we started talking about Southern films.
Yeah.
And this is made just a couple years after Forrest Gump. It was made just a few years after Driving Miss Daisy. This is Sling Blade with Billy Bob Thornton in the lead character.
Can I help you, sir?
I kind of want something other to eat.
Mm-hmm. Well, what would you like?
You got any biscuits for sale in there?
Mm. Stratton, what does this film tell you about or represent when it comes to Southern film?
Well, when Billy Bob did the film, I've known him for a few years as well. He is a Southerner. He was born and raised here in the South. He drew on people that he had come across during his life, and reasonably, in my estimation, reasonably accurate.
Okay. So you find that a positive portrayal, you think? I mean, or at least a positive...
I find it a reasonably accurate portrayal.
Okay.
And positive is a different thing.
It is a different thing. And Kalina, I wanted to talk to you then about one of your favorite Southern films. Again, we're just kind of moving forward in history. This is from the year 2000, O Brother, Where Art Thou? Starring, of course, George Clooney, playing Everett, who's very, very careful about his hair.
Hold on now. I don't want this pomade. I want Dapper Dan.
I don't care Dapper Dan. I care Fop.
But I don't want. I'm a Dapper Dan man.
Why this film, Kalina?
I love that movie so much. That film was just beautiful to me. The one thing about the South in film is it can easily be fall into the realm of fantasy because there are beautiful images that arrive from the South. Even when you see, you know, stories that deal with kind of the sadder and more angry times of the South, the trees, the moss hanging off the trees and the beautiful landscapes and things like that. Location-wise, as a locations professional, I was loving it.
Yeah,
and,
it was beautiful.
In terms of, you know, their accents and things like that,
But also the storytelling. This is what Eddie was referring to earlier, and I guess in calling this the South, the Ireland of America, that is one thing that keeps people coming back to the South is this rich history of stories.
Absolutely. I mean, we steep ourselves in folklore. It's the story around this film. The story in this film was just, it was fun. It was just fun to see what they were going to do and how they were going to get back to their families and that sort of thing. It was great.
I love that film. Yeah. It's by probably the most talented, one of the most talented teams of filmmakers.
Oh, the Coen Brothers.
Absolutely.
And it's beautiful. It's sumptuous. It's beautiful. It's also, I think, extremely nostalgic and really plays to a lot of those caricatures of Southerness. And again, this is one of the things that makes this such a fascinating subject is there's nothing realistic about Oh Brother, Where Art
Thou?
But these are also two brothers born in Minnesota.
Well, sure. And we love this South, this antique South, this nostalgic South. And it's beautiful and it's fascinating and there are wonderful stories to tell. But at the same time, it's a distortion of the South.
Well, let me ask you, and maybe Stratton, it would be fair to ask you whether or not we consider Tyler Perry a Southern filmmaker. Let's take a listen first to Tyler Perry playing his most famous character. This is from the movie in 2009, Madea Goes to Jail.
Next case.
City of Atlanta versus Mabel Simmons.
Hey, Jared. Oh, Carol, your hair is so pretty. Who doing your hair? Lord have mercy, how you doing?
Mabel Simmons, you come before me more than you go to the doctor for a checkup.
Listen, I changed my life. You ain't got to say that. I am living for the Lord.
Stratton, would we call Tyler Perry's film Southern?
Well, by definition, he's a Southern filmmaker because he's there. He's in Atlanta. His films, it goes back to what we'd said earlier about stereotypes, in a sense, doesn't it?
He is kind of playing into a stereotype, a particular type of grandmotherly auntie figure.
Sure.
But at the same time, I don't think this is specifically a Southern representation of this caricature. We can find this representation across the country.
Did you mean to say caricature or character?
Character. I am sorry.
Though it is kind of both.
Oh, there you go. So you could find this across the country, really.
We can frame the same argument when you think Big Fat Greek Wedding, even though it was shot in Canada, crosses all, I mean, I have Chinese friends that respond to it. It crosses a lot of ethnic lines.
Okay, so not necessarily a Southern story. But right before we go, and we don't have a lot of time left, but I have to bring us forward to modern times with David Oyelowo playing Martin Luther King and, of course, the critically acclaimed film Selma from last year.
There were no words that I can tell you one thing for certain. God was the first to cry. He was the first to cry for your boy.
Yes, I believe that.
Eddie, this brings us forward, but this is also a film that's set 50 years ago. So has the Southern stereotype really disappeared?
No. I think that it has been joined. I think we now have several cinematic Souths and that they coexist on screens. I think it's legitimate at this point to say that the civil rights drama is a genre. It's been a pretty productive genre, actually, since the 1990s. I also think that we should consider African-American cinema in the South as creating one of the cinematic Souths on screens.
Absolutely.
And we definitely still have the persistence of the kind of folksy, rural, rednecky, whether it's in a comic mode or a dramatic mode, that's still very much there. So I think we now have multiple Souths.
That's Eddie Van Mueller. He's a film and media studies lecturer at Emory University. We also spoke with Stratton Leopold, a film producer based in Savannah, and Kalina Bowler works in scouting film locations. She's also co-host of the Real Stomps podcast. Thanks so much to all three of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just ahead, what will we sound like in 30 years? This is On Second Thought.
Just a good old boy, never meaning no harm. Beats all you never saw. Been in trouble with the law since the day they was born. Straight in the curve, yeah. Flattening the hills.
I'm Celeste Headlee. This is On Second Thought. We're focused this hour on speaking Southern. And that means not just the words, but the way we say them. There have been a lot of complaints about Kevin Spacey's accent in the Netflix series House of Cards.
We had our own brand of diplomacy. Shake with your right hand, but hold a rock in your left.
People say it is not a real Southern accent, and that's a relatively common complaint. Spacey is not the only one with a questionable silver screen twang. Here's Christopher Reeve from the 1984 film The Bostonians.
Miss Tarrant said in her note, "This is a place you can wear your old clothes and lie on the ground." Well, I'd delight to lie on the ground. All my clothes are old. I hope to be able to stay 3 or 4 weeks.
Accents are complicated. They're often intertwined with identity. So we brought in a couple of linguists to answer our questions about them. Eric Thomas teaches at North Carolina State University. Dennis Preston teaches at Oklahoma State University. That's some geographic variety for you. I asked Eric if there's any such thing as a real Southern accent.
Well, a linguist would say that it's sort of, you have a bunch of different features, and it's a matter of a person having enough of those features, although not all Southern accents have all the particular features.
I wanted to ask about the individual accents, like whether or not there's a Georgia accent. And to start off, let's play the quintessential Georgian, right? I mean, what many people think of when they think of Atlanta and Georgia. And this is the character Scarlett O'Hara, played by Vivian Leigh, in 1939's Gone with the Wind.
What do we care if we were expelled from college, Scarlett? The war's gonna start any day now, so we'd have left college anyhow.
War? Isn't it exciting, Scarlett? You know those poor Yankees actually want a war?
We'll show them.
Fiddle-dee-dee. War, war, war. This war talk's spoiling all the fun at every party this spring. I get so bored I could scream.
So that, I mean, immediately you hear, war, war, war. Dennis, is that a true Georgia accent, or was that some idea of the South?
Well, I think almost all popular representations in media, film, and whatever are all representations of ideas of a South. And as Eric just suggested, there's of course no one South. And of course, the other peculiarly interesting thing is that dialects just don't care anything about state lines. So when dialects are formed, the difference between Georgia and Alabama and Georgia and South Carolina is not very important. On the other hand, the Appalachian section of Georgia in northwest Georgia is very, very different from what we call coastal Southern, the kind of stuff that you would find closer to the ocean in the southern part of the state. So, no, there's no such thing as a Georgia accent. There's just a whole bunch of Georgia accents. Education plays a role, certainly. So I hate to disappoint people in Georgia, but there's no such thing as Georgia speech, as there's no such thing as a Southern speech. There are a whole bunch of Southern dialects and a whole bunch of Georgia dialects.
Well, I don't want to use them interchangeably. Eric, can you explain the difference between a dialect and an accent?
An accent basically refers to pronunciation features, whereas a dialect refers to not just pronunciation, but also things like vocabulary and grammatical features.
The words you use, like whether you say y'all or you guys. I'm from California originally, so I say you guys, and I keep getting corrected.
Yeah, I'm from Ohio. I say you guys, too.
Well, you guys are just wrong. I'm from Louisville, and interestingly, in Louisville, we don't say y'all. We say you all. And so when I moved a little further south, then I had to do away with my two syllables and come up with the one syllable y'all.
Well, there's also efforts to preserve the southern dialect. So there's a project called Roswell Voices in Roswell, Georgia, that collects oral histories from some of the older residents. And let's take a listen. Here is Virginia Adams, who was interviewed for this project.
Those were WPA days, and the days when you asked the government for money to do things, and it was to give people a job.
Now, that is a real accent. Let's take a listen to one more, and this is Dorsey Coleman.
And I had a water bucket sitting in the corner of the room with a dipper in it. Everybody drank out of the same dipper. I had to go to somebody's well in the neighborhood to get the water. The outhouse was down in the woods.
So, Eric, what are we hearing there? What identifies that particular accent?
Well, there are a couple of things that you could that would stand out. The first speaker, I think she said ask, something like ask.
Yeah.
That was that's one that actors don't usually pick up on. The second person said water instead of water. So having that particular pronunciation of water with a different vowel in the first syllable is the kind of thing that linguist would notice, and probably the average person might pick up on.
So what about the disappearance of the R? A lot of people have pointed, especially to Kevin Spacey, and said that getting rid of the R is kind of an outmoded way of speaking. Dennis, do people still do that?
Oh, there are still people who are, well, us linguists like to say R-less. This dropping of R is rapidly disappearing. For example, our colleague Bill LeBove, who's most famous for his studies in New York City, noticed the increasing disappearance of R over time in New York City, and the same thing is happening now in the South. So the items that you played for us are they're excellent language preservation things, but they're pretty old-fashioned. They have a decidedly rural sound to me, although in urban areas, in generations before, people would have sounded very much like this. But just let's make sure that we know one thing. Southern speech is not disappearing. The Southern speech of two generations ago is disappearing, and what we'll get is a new Southern speech, because it's just the matter of language and dialects. The change happens all the time, and some people are happy to see change, and I think the majority of people are kind of sad to see change, because they feel that change represents a loss of values and lifestyle. But I guarantee you that 100 years from now, there'll still be a Southern speech and a Northern speech. They just won't be the same as they were 50 years ago.
And yet, Dennis, give me some guidance on how to sound more authentic. One of our listeners called in and said that the addition of the pronunciation of the H, in other words, he talks about the alcoholic beverage as wine, but then if somebody's complaining, he'll say they're whining.
Well, he's a dying breed just like me. Now, I'm a really old guy from Louisville, Kentucky, and I love to distinguish between which and which. But if you look at recent surveys, you'll see that there's just a handful of us guys left. So if you want to sound anything like a Southerner, don't go around practicing your which, because there are very, very few Southerners left who have this distinction. If you go to Scotland or Northern Ireland, that might be a good thing for you to learn. But in Atlanta, which is not going to help you at all. It used to be a very strong feature. Well, of course, it used to be a strong feature all over the United States, but very, very rapidly it died out. It actually died out in the south of England, what we think of as posh British speech. It died out there a long time before it even died out in America.
Well, what about greasy? Eric, somebody told me that I need to pronounce, instead of greasy, I need to say greasy. What about that?
That's another traditional Southern feature. Also the verb to grease or to grease goes along with it, but it's declining not quite as fast as the WH distinction, but you hear fewer and fewer people who have the say greasy instead of greasy.
Be careful with that one though, because I know some Northerner who tried to learn grease and greasy, which is the correct way to say it, of course, as anybody in Louisville, Kentucky will tell you. But then they overgeneralized, and they thought the noun was grease, too. But it's not, as any Southerner will tell you. The noun is grease. The adjective is greasy, and the verb is to grease. So be careful. Trying to learn to sound like somebody you aren't is going to get you in a big bitch of trouble.
Yeah.
That'd be pretty lousy if you said that the town is Grease.
All right, well, let's do another one. And I hate to bring you back to Scarlett O'Hara because neither one of you seems to have a whole lot of respect for actors' accents. But what about the sometimes turning one-syllable words into two syllables, like woa? Dennis?
Well, I think there we don't get so much as a two-syllable word as we do as linguists would call this the compensation for the loss of the R. So if we have a word like war and don't do the R, then notice there's a little there that substitutes for the R. So when in all dialects, when R is lost, whether it's British English or some other variety, there's a compensation for that loss. People don't just lose R. If you say war and lose R, you get wah. And nobody says that. Actually, in Boston and some other places, there's not so much lengthening. But we do, of course, get what sound like extra syllables. But this is from the famous effect known as the drawl, where words like live can become live. And so forth,
right.
Where an extra little glide is put into them, and they all, I guess you call them two-syllable, but that's the thing I think that Northerners perceive more than anything else is when this glide is introduced. And Eric, in fact, has studied that drawl feature phonetically a lot, as along with a colleague of ours from Anniston, Alabama, by the name of Corky Fagan.
Let me put one last clip to you, and this brings us back to the complaints that kind of sparked this conversation. Here is Kevin Spacey playing Congressman Frank Underwood in House of Cards.
I've always loathed the necessity of sleep. Like death, it puts even the most powerful men on their backs. The heart can choke the mind when all its blood flows back unto itself. There can be no false steps now. The higher up the mountain, the more treacherous the path.
Dennis, there's been linguists really angry about his accent. I wouldn't say angry, but just saying that accent doesn't actually exist. What's your reaction when you hear that?
For me, there's a big difference between art and science. So that if actors portrayed a specific person, time, place, and so forth, I think this would probably be overkill. Someone said about literary dialect writing a long time ago, if you actually wrote down a really good representation of a dialect in literature, then nobody else would read it. So the people who are authentic speakers from a certain place are always going to be dissatisfied.
Dennis Preston of Oklahoma State University and Eric Thomas of North Carolina State University. Now, before we end today, I want to look ahead, way ahead, to say 2050. What will you sound like? What will I sound like? Linguist James Harbeck explored this question in an op-ed for the website The Week. He joined us by Skype from Toronto. I began by asking him why he's so interested in the future of our speech.
I am just fascinated by the way language changes. If you start looking at the history of the English language, you discover that things that we thought have always been that way actually have changed quite a bit. And at the same time, things that we think are really new things have actually been that way for a very long time. So it's quite reasonable to wonder, what's it going to be like 35, 50, 100 years from now?
So what are the things that influence our speech that we can kind of point to and say, oh, look, that changed things? You know, I'm thinking of like I grew up in Southern California. So at some point, something came along and made people start talking like Valley Girls, like, oh, my God. So what are the things that we can point to, or you can as a researcher, and say, OK, this will influence speech?
There are a number of different things, and not all of them are easy to identify. Sometimes you have a sort of a vector from popular culture. Somebody will come up with something, say, on Saturday Night Live. It'll turn into a fad way of, usually those are the slang terms and so forth. When it comes to things like changes in accent, like the Valley Girl talk, it's a lot harder to say exactly why people do that. The entire English vowel system over a period of a couple of hundred years before Shakespeare changed noticeably, so that E became I and A became E and A became A. And this is one of the reasons our spelling is so weird, because our vowels all changed and we're not really sure exactly why. But a lot of these changes seem to be innovations partly driven by a need for improving status, to have an in-group that sounds a little more different, a little better from others. That's speculative, but there is some observation that seems to support that.
Well, let's give you an example of a bad accent from movies. This is Christopher Reeve in the 1984 film The Bostonians.
Miss Tarrant said in her note, "This is a place you can wear your old clothes and lie on the ground." Well, I delight to lie on the ground. All my clothes are old. I hope to be able to stay 3 or 4 weeks.
I'm not really sure what accent he's using there. It's not a real one, but, you know, we do hear celebrities especially picking up things like British accents, right? And using those to in some way signify elevated status or maybe intellectualism. Is that a way that speech can be influenced?
Oh, certainly. Absolutely. In fact, the famous R dropping that you get in New York and Boston, although it's disappearing somewhat in New York, it's still persists in much of New England, came from a desire to sound more like people in England. It was originally a higher status thing. And what happened was that as the people at lower socioeconomic levels latched onto it, the people at the upper levels moved on. They said, oh, no, this doesn't sound like Americans. And these people, they sound a little too loudish. And there may have been effect also of immigrants, lower class immigrants coming in from places where they did that as a feature of their speech. And so all of a sudden you don't want to sound like those people.
Okay, so let me use a couple clips here of Brooke Shields. These are things that you pointed to in your op-ed. First, there's a clip of her during an interview in 1980. She was only 15 years old.
They don't even treat me any differently. That doesn't bother them at all. I think that the way it has affected me is that the press, usually, had given me such a hard time that it made me a stronger person.
And here is Brooke Shields again, another interview, but this time 35 years later.
I wrote an obituary, and then I was very much misrepresented. When the obituary came out, it actually was nothing that I had written.
What do you hear here that's of interest?
Well, the thing about Brooke Shields is that while her voice, her tone, you know, the vocal register has gone down a little bit, a lot of the features of her accent have stayed remarkably stable. She's talking about, say, represented obituary. If you take somebody who is at the age now that Brooke Shields was back in the 1980s, such as Abigail Breslin, you would hear something more like obituary and represented. The vowels are shifting downwards, but it's an intergenerational thing. It's subtle. And the interesting thing is that Brooke Shields is largely keeping the accent that she had when she was about 18, which is very common for people to do. Once they lock in at a certain point, the rest is usually tinkering unless you make a major geographic or social set change, and then you're making a conscious effort.
I've been speaking with language expert James Harbeck. Thank you so much, James.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today, but we would love to hear your accent. Are you a Georgian native? Do you have an accent? Call us and let us hear it. The number is 404-500-9457. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day, y'all.